Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm here to introduce our show to you today, August 6, 2005, Hiroshima Day. Our focus today is on commemorating Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the 60th anniversaries of their bombing. In our first hour, we feature an interview with Macy Morse, longtime peace and justice activist and resident of Portsmouth. She talks about her work to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons and her trip to Japan. Our second hour will have Tom Jackson interviewing Jane Bernhardt, an artist, activist, and actress from Massachusetts and the co-founder of the Hibakusha Peace Project. The Hibakusha are the survivors of the bombs that were dropped 60 years ago. We'll end with the latest episode of Between the Lines out of Connecticut. We'll also bring you great music, announcements, and more. First, for some news. From a press release from the Grassroots Radio Coalition, two new radio stations step up international struggle for airwaves control. Media reform campaign goes global with the launch of tiny radio stations in Northampton, Massachusetts and Arusha, Tanzania, August 4th through 7th. In an extraordinary event this summer, ordinary people will be gaining access to the airwaves, two radio stations at a time. From August 4th through 7th, more than 400 people will gather in Northampton, Mass. To launch Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, a 100-watt licensed radio station. As Valley Free Radio takes flight with its first broadcast, we'll also be building the transmitter for an international sister station in Arusha, Tanzania. Both of these exciting events are part of the Grassroots Radio Conference and Radio Barn Raising. The Grassroots Radio Conference is an annual convergence of media activists, producers, and community radio stations from the U.S. and Canada. The launch of Valley Free Radio marks the first time the GRC will coincide with a Prometheus Radio Project barn raising. The VFR barn raising, Prometheus's eighth, will bring community radio enthusiasts together to build and launch the radio station over the course of a single weekend. Immediately after the GRC, a team of engineers, radio and video producers, and volunteers will travel to Arusha to help get the United African Alliance Community Center's station on the air. Both Valley Free Radio and the UAACC's radio station will be public, volunteer-run spaces for community education, discussion, and debate. They will also help support the development of local musical artists. Prometheus volunteer Sarah Miller said, "Community radio stations like Valley Free Radio and the UAACC are essential in paving the way to a more democratic and participatory media landscape. Radio barn raisings turn people's concerns about the state of mainstream media into something tangible. Bricks and mortar radio stations for the people of Northampton and Arusha." Valley Free Radio Board co-chair Tim Scott said, "It is exciting for Valley Free Radio to be launching our small community radio station while directly participating in the international movement to take back the airwaves for the interests of people instead of profit." For more information on the Grassroots Radio Conference and Radio Barn Raisings, visit www.prometheusradio.org. And now for a story about a news story. This is a press release from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Misjudging Roberts. Newsweek dismisses accurate information on judge's record. Like much of the mainstream media coverage, Newsweek magazine's August 1st cover story on Supreme Court nominee John G. Roberts was overwhelmingly positive. But Newsweek went even further than most, dismissing as inaccurate stories that depicted Roberts as a conservative partisan, even though it was Newsweek, in fact, that was getting the stories wrong. Newsweek led off its report by saying that, quote, true believers on the left and the right, hoping to rouse their armies for a showdown over John Roberts, immediately trumpeted two facts. Both intriguing items about Roberts, widely reported in the mainstream media, served as fodder for the talk show blab wars. Problem is, they aren't true. Unquote. The first supposed falsehood: liberal bloggers floated conspiracy theories about the behind-the-scenes role he played on Bush's legal team in an epic court fight after the 2000 election, a contribution that supposedly earned the president's undying gratitude. The reality, according to Newsweek, Roberts' role in the case of Bush v. Gore was minimal, according to colleagues who worked with him. Roberts did briefly go to Florida to be on hand as a legal consultant, but he was preoccupied with working on the adoption of a baby son. As it turns out, the liberal bloggers' conspiracy theories were closer to the mark, as more careful reporting revealed that Roberts was an important part of the Bush legal team. According to a report in the Miami Herald on July 27, 2005, Roberts worked, quote, as legal consultant, lawsuit editor, and prep coach for arguments before the nation's highest court, according to the man who drafted him for the job, end quote. The Herald noted that Roberts was considered one of the top names for the effort, which he worked on for a week to 10 days. As Bush advisor Ted Cruz told the paper, quote, there was no one better for the job, end quote. Newsweek's other gotcha. Right-wingers smugly assumed Roberts' membership in the Federalist Society, an organization that has taken on an almost cultish mystique as both incubator and old boys' network for conservative jurists and lawyers in Washington. Here, Newsweek was following the line of the White House, which went so far as to demand corrections from media outlets that had reported Roberts was a Federalist Society member. But as the Washington Post revealed, July 25, 2005, Roberts was not only listed in the group's 1997-98 leadership directory, he's named as a member of the Washington chapter's steering committee. Dismissing these accurate stories served to bolster Newsweek's claim that Roberts was conservative but apolitical, and that his confirmation was a sure thing. As the magazine put it, Roberts' marginal involvement as a political activist is revealing. It suggests that Roberts is not the hardline ideologue that true believers on both sides had hoped for. Indeed, Newsweek could hardly contain its enthusiasm about a nominee who, quote, sees the law as a set of time-tested rules that allow people to work out their differences and to trust each other, a body of principles and precedents that bring order and predictability to civic life, which have the effect not of dividing but of harmonizing and unifying society, end quote. The magazine concluded that, from all that can be gleaned about Roberts, he will decide each case, one at a time, with great intellectual rigor and honesty. Given that Newsweek led its story with mischaracterizations about Roberts' record, intellectual rigor and honesty would compel the magazine to set the record straight for its readers. But this week's issue of Newsweek, 8805, did not correct the article's inaccurate assertions. FAIR asks you to consider contacting Newsweek and ask them to correct their inaccurate claims. Their email address is letters@newsweek.com. In keeping with our theme today on the show of commemorating Hiroshima, we bring you this story from Reuters about current issues in Japan. Hiroshima, a pacifist bastion, 60 years after A-bomb. 60 years after the atomic bombing that killed thousands in the blink of an eye and devastated his home city of Hiroshima, Suneo Suboi is worried Japan may again be headed down the path of militarism. The survivor of the world's first atomic bombing has vowed, like many other Hiroshima residents, to keep the city a bastion of pacifism. "Everything I hear these days makes me really upset," said Suboi, 80, who was a university student when the bomb exploded over Hiroshima on the morning of August 6, 1945. Suboi, who was about 1 kilometer from ground zero, was hurled 10 meters through the air and suffered burns over much of his body. I get a strong feeling that Japan is leaning to the right, that we're going down a road that we've been down before, he said, his face still visibly scarred from the burns. Japan's ruling party, in its latest call for a more assertive security stance, this week proposed that the military should not be limited to a self-defense role, but should take part in international efforts to secure peace overseas. Prime Minister Kozami has made annual visits to Tokyo's Yasukuni Shrine for War Dead, seen by critics as a symbol of Japan's past militarism, and a school textbook written by nationalist historians has stirred criticism of a whitewash. Proposals laid out in a draft for a new constitution by Koizumi's Liberal Democratic Party mark a drastic departure from the principles of the pacifist constitution, unchanged since it was drafted by the post-war occupation authorities. A key section of the Constitution, Article 9, renounces the right to maintain military or wage war, though Japanese governments have interpreted it as allowing forces for defense, the now 240,000-member self-defense forces. We must by all means save Article 9. It may be idealistic, but it's something that the world should strive to achieve, said Tsuboi, who heads a group of Hiroshima victims. Recent administrations have stretched the constraints of the Constitution to allow non-combat support for the U.S.-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but many members of the conservative LDP have long chafed at the limits of the U.S.-drafted document. Faced with the threat of North Korea's missile and nuclear programs, Japanese public opinion has shifted away from once overwhelming opposition to revising Article 9, although those backing a change still fall short of a majority. Some politicians have even broken a decades-old taboo to suggest Japan should possess nuclear arms. Motofumi Asai, a former diplomat who is president of the Hiroshima Peace Institute, said, "Japan is clearly leaning to the right, and the trend has become very strong." In Hiroshima, now a modern, bustling city of 1.2 million, the mood is different. In places like Tokyo, pacifism is no longer fashionable, but in Hiroshima it's still very much alive, Asai said. In Hiroshima, people have a strong sense of identity as victims of the A-bomb. They feel they have to be a beacon of pacifism and of efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. The Peace Memorial Park and the A-bomb Dome, the ruined shell of a building that was near Ground Zero, have become synonymous with the city and serve as reminders of the bombing 60 years ago this week. Faced with the passing of the generation who experienced the bombing, most schools in Hiroshima have peace studies courses to keep memories of the tragedy alive. 16-year-old Madaka Tamara, a student at the private Notre Dame Seishin High School, said, "We should stick with Article 9. Someone has to give up weapons because otherwise others won't." Some of her classmates said Japan may need a military for self-defense, but should keep to its pacifist principles. 17-year-old Haruka Daimyoji said, "As a country which suffered war and is one of the only two cities that have suffered an atomic bombing, we need to have a strong desire for peace. If the military were to get out of control, we are the ones to stop it." Others said debate on the Constitution and the military's role was fine as long as politicians recognized the consequences of war. "They should first visit the Peace Museum and then think about it," said Keitaro Nomura, president of Hiroshima Junior Chamber, an organization of young business executives. That's it for news today. Now we go to an interview with Macy Morse. This is Amy Antonucci for Making Waves. Today we're talking with Macy Morse, a longtime peace and justice activist living here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. One focus of Macy's activism for many years has been on anti-nuclear weapons campaigns. This work brought Macy on a visit to Hiroshima in 2003. Now, at the age of 84, Macy continues to work against nuclear weapons, including helping to plan a commemoration ceremony in Portsmouth this coming Tuesday, August 9th, Nagasaki Day. On the anniversary of the United States' dropping of an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, we talk with her about her experiences and the issues. Welcome, Macy. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Amy, for having me.
I'd like to start by going back when the bombs were actually dropped, what your awareness of the situation was, and if you were at that point already active.
Well, I was not active at that time in 1945. I was married and I had one small child. My husband was in the military. He was in the Navy in the South Pacific. And one of my neighbors across the street, we lived in the country, she was an older woman. She came over and said, "Have you heard on the radio that they've dropped the bomb on Japan and they're going to surrender? So then the war will be over." And so we were both elated. She had sons that were in the military, and my husband was gone, and my sister's husband was gone. And so we were very excited that the war was over. Gave no thought to the severity of the kind of bomb they were talking about, as being a different bomb, and not explaining what it was or what it meant. We had no idea. So that was my introduction to the nuclear weaponry without any information.
How did you become aware and active in stopping nuclear weapon proliferation?
Like many things, an awareness often creeps up on you. I was very busy raising a family. And I remember reading, after we had moved to the East Coast, I remembered reading that there were Quakers and others protesting the launching of submarines, or the building of submarines, in Connecticut. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. By that time, I must have had some awareness of what an atomic bomb was, that it was pretty devastating. We had no idea. We were never told how many people were killed with that bomb, or that the whole community was just wiped out. As you know, people were just blown into shadows on the wall. There's an organization from Oregon that is going around with shadows on the wall, showing that the radiation from atomic bomb just can leave just a shadow of that person, with the person having evaporated. But we hadn't learned that yet. But there were things creeping out about radiation and nuclear weaponry being built and so forth. And I thought in the 50s that I would like to have gone down to Connecticut and taken part in that protest. And I admired the people who were doing it. But I didn't know how. I didn't know how to do that. I think that's one of the things that I've learned over the years, that you ask people, you invite people to join you. You find out who's interested. That builds a community, and you go from there.
Can you tell us a story of the first time you did do something against nuclear weapons?
I actually learned about what had happened in Hiroshima when I was working with a group in Nashua, New Hampshire, called Voice. It was volunteers organized to assist low-income people. We were protesting electric rates that the public service company had for people who used a minimal amount of electricity, such as the very low-income people living in housing and so forth, public housing. In going to public service company and going to the Public Utilities Commission, we found out that Seabrook was going to plan to build a nuclear power plant. A group of people got together locally in the state and talked about the financial and the health issues and the environmental issues surrounding that, and we began educating ourselves about the impact of nuclear radiation on those three elements. At that same time, now that would have been 1975, 76, that I got involved then with the group that eventually called themselves Clamshell Alliance, and helped to prevent the nuclear power plant at Seabrook from going online for 14 years, and also preventing it from ever putting in the second reactor. So in some ways, I think Clamshell was very effective, certainly in delaying the damage to the environment and the health of the surrounding community. So we learned about nuclear radiation and its effect on the environment. Several of us, we had formed our own group here in New Hampshire, and we were on our way down to Washington, D.C., had an appointment with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to talk about the dangers. Now we're learning about Maine Yankee Nuclear Station and the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Station, and those are already working. And they're planning to build Seabrook, a nuclear power station. And so we want to go down and talk about safety measures, particularly at Vermont Yankee at that time, which was running with broken, sheared off bolts and so forth. So as several of us are going down, one of the people said, oh, did you know they were going to launch the first Trident submarine at Groton, Connecticut? Well, what's a Trident submarine, you know? Well, it has 400 nuclear weapons on it, and each one of them, I don't know how many times larger than the one that wiped out Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, well, would it be worthwhile to stop and join in this demonstration that's going on there? Well, we had an appointment on Monday morning, this is Friday afternoon, and we stopped and took part in the protest the next day. We were arrested, and the trial was postponed, and so we went on our way to Washington. And when we got to Washington, we found out that the people around the country, it was on one of the first environmental days in April, they were having huge rallies on the Mall in Washington. People were planning a huge demonstration on Monday morning, walking from the Department of Energy to the Department of Defense to connect the nuclear energy power plants to the nuclear weaponry. Well, we already knew a little bit about that, but we're going to learn more about it. And we decided that we'd postpone our meeting with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because this seemed to be a much more important issue to make this connection. Many of us gathered at the Department of Energy, marched across the bridge to the Pentagon. I got separated from the small little group that we had had in New Hampshire, and was subsequently arrested and thrown into the entranceway to the Pentagon. And I happened to be thrown right in with Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan and Dave Dellinger and Harvey Wasserman and Howard Moreland, and I helped to carry the a big peace crane from Bread and Puppet Theater across the bridge. And this man, not much taller than I am, walked up alongside of me and said hi, and I looked at him and I thought, oh, that's not Daniel Ellsberg. Oh, it can't be Daniel Ellsberg. But pretty soon he says, hello, my name's Daniel Ellsberg, who are you? And so we got to talking, and I said, did you used to have your office up in this building? And he pointed out the window to me.
So, what year was this?
This was 1980, April 1980. So I'd been working just with the nukes at Seabrook from about 1975 on up to that time. Now I've made the full connection and found out that Phil Berrigan and his wife had established a community in Baltimore, and they were working against nuclear weapons. That was their total focus.
Tell us about your trip to Japan. Were you part of a delegation? How did that trip come about?
That was interesting because I was not part of a delegation. And, of course, one, when you work in a particular field like I have over the years, I always felt like I really needed to be in Japan, in Hiroshima, and be at that spot and see the damage that had happened. Of course, you're not going to see it. You're not going to even feel it, not the way that it happened to the people. But come as close as I could to it. 2.5 years ago, I had the opportunity to go with my family. My grandson married a young woman from Tokyo, and I was invited to go to the wedding. I was accompanied by loving people, my own family, two of my sons and my daughter-in-law and my grandchildren, and we were received very well by the Japanese people, the future relatives of my grandson. And, of course, one of the things my sons and I were interested in was getting down to Hiroshima. So we went down on the bullet train and stayed overnight. And the next day we went out and went to the park, the Peace Park, saw the skeleton that's left of the building that's so famous. By the way, going back to 1976, when Clamshell was working to stop the building of Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, that was the first time that the release of the official Army footage had come out about what had happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So you're beginning to see that devastation that we had never seen before, that we'd always, sometimes it was whispered about, occasionally you'd hear little bits and pieces, but nobody that I knew ever knew anything about what happened there until that film came out. I think it was 1975 it was finally released, and I saw it in 76. So here I am, seeing this famous skeleton of the municipal building that was bombed and part of it left standing. It's a beautiful park. It has all kinds of memorabilia and little spots for reflection where different events took place that day. Of course, the story of Sadako, who was affected by the radiation and didn't die until many years after she had been irradiated by that bomb. There's a story in Japanese that if you make 1,000 cranes, you get your wish. And so she wanted to be cured of this leukemia that she had and started to make the 1,000 cranes and died before she could finish that project. And so her friends picked it up, and people around the world have picked it up. We're all still making paper cranes, hoping that that will help our feelings when we're working to stop the nuclear weaponry.
How old was she when she died?
She was 12.
Mm-hmm. How old was she when the bomb was dropped?
She was young. She was 5 or 6.
So what else did you see and experience in Japan?
I want to say a little bit about the memorial. There's a huge museum that is a memorial to that awful day. And one walks into it, and one of the first things you see is a video, a multiple viewing screen of the planes that left the islands to fly over Japan that day. There's actual footage of that shown. And then the footage of it actually flying and dropping the bombs and the resulting mushroom cloud that is so typical. That's very powerful in itself. And then you see the history of war in Japan, from their viewpoint, of course, and its involvement down through the centuries. Like our history, like history of so many countries, it's been one war after the other, until this horrible, horrible dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and the wiping out of, 150,000 people in just a few minutes, a moment. This video details all of that and shows the destruction, and then goes on, and there are little scenes throughout this memorial. There are pictures of people, stories of people. It probably took about 3 hours to go through this museum and read the stories and to see the little still lifes of figures. Mother half burned and her child charcoal and trying to hold it in her arms. And those things actually happened that day. And we mustn't forget that this is what war is, and nuclear war especially is so devastating. You go on through the building and come to the gift shop, and you want to have some memory of having been here, and yet nothing was adequate. I went away without any souvenir from that place because I just could not find anything that I felt told the story the way I had felt it. I walked outside and I was in a daze. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know why I was where I was. Fortunately, my young grandson and his friend, who'd been living in Tokyo for 2 years, they came to my rescue and helped me come back to where we are now. And we went for ramen noodles. So that was my experience there. I didn't feel like I had seen everything I needed to see. I really wanted to meet the mayor of Hiroshima, who has come up with a petition to have the mayors of the world sign to abolish nuclear weapons. And I understand that our mayor in Manchester has signed this petition, and I congratulate him on having chosen to do that.
What other campaigns are going on to stop nuclear weaponry?
At the current time, there are still the Plowshares actions. The two Berrigan brothers got together with other people who wanted to abolish nuclear weapons and formed a group they called Plowshares and took the biblical injunction of Isaiah to turn swords into plowshares. For many years, they've gone to sites where either the weapons were manufactured or the missile silos in Missouri or South Dakota, places like that. I've been to a missile silo in South Dakota. It's the only place I've been. But I've also been to the manufacturer of the MX and Pershing missiles, which were being built in 1983. There were seven of us visited a plant in Wilmington, Massachusetts that made parts for the MX and Pershing, which were going to be sent to Europe, England, Belgium, Holland, Sicily. They were the newest weaponry on the block. And at that time, with Russia as our adversary, people would say, oh, but it's a deterrent. Well, it wasn't a deterrent. It would be an aggravation to the Russians, the Soviet Union at that time. It just seemed like they were just building ever more ferocious weaponry, horrible, indescribable nuclear weaponry. So we went into that plant and helped ourselves to some of the contracts by pouring blood on them and some of the weaponry, the MX missile parts, a computer for the Pershing and so on.
And you were arrested and had a pretty high-profile trial for this, is that right?
We did. We were on trial in Lowell for 3 weeks. At that trial, Setsuko Thurlow, who was in Hiroshima the day that the U.S. bombed Hiroshima, actually saw much of the devastation. She remembers seeing people just melting away or being blown into smithereens. And she was young at the time, and we wanted her to testify at our trial because we wanted to show motivation, intent and motivation. The judge ruled that she couldn't testify because Hiroshima was a long time ago and didn't have anything to do with today. But I disagree with that, of course.
Which leads me to another question I'd like to ask you about the relevancy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What lessons have been learned that you see? What lessons need to be learned in revisiting this history and retelling these stories? What is your hope?
So what is the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Well, we know that it left great devastation, great pollution. It ruined the health of the living. And, of course, it killed over 150,000 people. And Nagasaki was bombed 3 days later. The U.S. used a different type of bomb. The first one was a uranium, the Nagasaki bomb. Well, they developed the plutonium bomb, so we got to try that out. And I think that we have to be more careful and give more thought to what it is we're doing. We're not caring enough about many of our actions, and one of them is we don't go around just vaporizing people or leaving behind Hibakusha. Those are the Japanese survivors. There are organizations of Hibakusha who work to stop nuclear weaponry, who have worked with the people who were injured or damaged, so many cancers after the dropping of that bomb. They've worked with those people to help restore their health and their lives, which of course would never come back to the reality of what they could have been. So the legacy for me is, the lesson for me to learn is that we need to work to build a creative world and not one where we destroy people, children.
What do you see as the challenges to that sort of vision and that work in the current world and the current political situation and world climate?
It's both discouraging and hopeful at the same time. Discouraging because there's a very fast-paced movement to build ever newer and more destructive weaponry, nuclear weaponry, and so on. And of course, we are using nuclear weapons. They're not called that by the military, the government, but the depleted uranium weaponry. And that's been used in Kosovo and Afghanistan and now in Iraq.
What are depleted uranium weapons?
Well, depleted uranium sounds benign, doesn't it? It sounds like, oh, well, it's depleted, so it's not harmful. But a depleted uranium missile has a hard cone. In fact, depleted uranium is so hard, it's probably the hardest thing we have that we've developed man-made. So it can penetrate tanks and covered places, you know, metal, more easily. It becomes an aerosol type of product. And that aerosol gets into your lungs or your digestive system. And then it can work as any other radioactive element that causes leukemia, cancer, and those sort of things. Hopeful, there are groups of people everywhere in the world, every place I go, in Japan, in China. I was just in China. And South Korea. I was in South Korea when the South Korean government was sending 2,000 Korean soldiers to Iraq because they're friends of the United States, and the United States needed more soldiers in Iraq, so Korea agreed to send 2,000. But they were doing it under protest, and I was there during the time that people were taking to the streets, and I talked with many of them, and they were very, very pleased that I work in the peace and justice movement, and they were just thrilled, and that was a very good experience to be in a foreign country where I don't know the language and I have to have an interpreter, and I'm on the street and I meet people that I've never seen before and I'll never see again. But I know that we're all working together, and they know that I'm working with you and other people in this community. And that's true in England. I have friends in England who email me, and we've worked with them for 20 years and we're still working. And one doesn't know what good we're doing. You don't ask, you know, what effect do I have? People say, I don't know what the effect is. I have no idea what the effect is. But we have to do what we have to do that is right. And you continue doing that. There are people all over the world trying to do what they think is right for caring for their neighbors, caring for each other. And our neighbors, we live in a global village, and our neighbors are right next door, no matter whether they're Japanese or Africans or Mexicans, we're all neighbors.
That's a wonderful thing to think about, that while this large global economic military structure is being built, that at the same time, in a quieter way, on a whole other level, connections and community and peacefulness and working together is being built by others.
Yes, it's extremely hopeful. You know, at 84, you don't want to go out thinking that everything is a downer. It isn't. There are beautiful people all over. And we may not stop nuclear weapons, but there's some deterrence to what we're doing.
So keep up the good work, Macy.
I will, but you'll have to do your own, Amy.
I will too. Thanks for being with us on Making Waves.
Thank you.
And children played in the playground, swinging on swings, didn't hear the sound of the single plane that flew overhead. The third shift workers were just going to bed. Was a flash of light and a rumbling noise, gone in an instant. Parents, girls, and boys, 10,000 mothers were boiling rice, 1,000 prisoners of war were rolling their dice, hoping they'd survive this terrible storm. When each young man in his uniform vanished in the air in the blink of an eye, one moment they lived, on the next they all died. Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Ten 10,000 chickens were sitting on eggs, beaks in their wings, rest in their legs. 10,000 farmers were looking at their fields, planning the harvest, guessing at yields, dreaming of life after the war. The next second they weren't living no more. Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Ten 10,000 lovers made love to each other, each one of them thinking there might not be another living so long. With death everywhere, much more than one person alone can bear. But there wasn't time for a final kiss. Who could have known it would end like this? Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Living their lives, grandparents, children, fathers and wives. Now they're just shadows on the street in such a quick burst of incredible heat. Now listen to them talk about doing it again. From whence came the souls of these terrible men? Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Hiroshima.
That was David Rovics with Hiroshima. We now hear from Michael Franti and Spearhead with Bomb the World.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. The whole world we divide. say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger. Violence brings one thing, more and more of the same. Military madness, smell of flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. All of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa.
This is Making Waves. You just heard Michael Franti in Spearhead with Bomb the World. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. to let us know what you think of our show, or to have us write up that long website for you, or to let us know you want to help. Also, feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info. The number is 430-9722. That's 430-WSCA.